I want to say the lecture today should be easier than my last lecture. I know that isn't much of a claim, but we don't have to do any of that a priori nonsense in this lecture. So this lecture should be easier, although remember I lied in the other lecture and said that one was easy, so maybe I'm lying again. We'll have to find out. Now, what I want to do in this lecture is discuss a couple themes you'll find in Mises' writings, and especially in Mises, you'll find this in some of the other Austrian economists also, but these themes we find especially in Mises, and I think if you can take note of these particular patterns of argument, you'll have at least the start of getting a good grasp on what Mises was up to in his writing. Now, at the time Mises was writing, in the period, say, from 1920 through the 60s, socialism was a much more of what William James called a live option for people than it is now. Nowadays, we don't have very many explicit socialists, and by socialists, I mean someone who thinks that the government should own all the means of production, that the economy should be run by a centralized plan. At the time Mises was writing, that was something that many people favored. A lot of people like to talk about the Soviet experiment. They've said, they're applying science to building a new society, and if they're having some rough spots, we should just kind of wait to see what happens, give them a chance. I said, when they talk about the Soviet experiment, it reminds me of the medieval phrase, experimentum in vile, which my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, used to translate, do it to the dog first. But so, as I say, socialism was a live option, and Mises, in a great deal of his writing, was concerned to counter the socialist arguments. Now, one of the main socialist arguments, and you'll still find people giving this argument today, is that under capitalism or the free market, the means of production are owned by a small group, namely the capitalists, the business people, and that the masses are really exploited by this small group of people. This is a very common theme in Marxism, but also held by other views as well. So the argument against the free market is, well, under the free market, it's just the small group that's in charge. The masses of the people really are not in control of things. Now, one way to counter that argument would be to say, and so the socialists said, well, that's what's wrong with capitalism. And so under socialism, the means of production are controlled by the government, but the government is really all of us. So under socialism, it's the means of production are democratically controlled. So then this argument makes a contrast between capitalism, where you have just a small group of wicked capitalists in control, and socialism, where it's the masses of the people in control. Of course, as it turned out in Russia, the masses of the people were led by the so-called vanguard party, the Communist Party, so it turned out to be a dictatorship. But the socialist propaganda said, no, it's the masses of people are in control under socialism, so this is better than capitalism, where you just have a few small group in control. And one way to counter that would be to say along the lines Murray Rothbard and others took, say, well, individuals have certain natural rights, and these include the rights include the right to acquire property individually. So if under the free market there are particular individuals who own the means of production, there's nothing at all wrong with that. That's, in fact, people are exercising their natural rights. But Mises didn't take that line for the quite good reason he didn't believe in natural rights. What he did, and this is a very characteristic theme you'll find in his writing, he would try to take the premise that the opponent of the free market had and show that the free market would better fulfill whatever it was that the opponent of the free market favored. So the opponent of the free market here is saying under capitalism, it's the small group that's in control, whereas under socialism, it's the whole people are in control. So Mises is going to counter that by saying, no, under capitalism, it's really the masses are in control. Now, what is his argument for that? It's a very simple one. He says, in the free market, business people are trying to make profit. And the way you make profit is to supply some good or service that consumers want. If you can, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. I don't know whether he actually said that, but we can see the principle that he said is quite true, unlike many other things that Emerson said, which usually false. That's to say, the ones that have a discernible meaning, which is only about maybe 10% of them. So the idea is, if you want to make money under free market, you have to come up with some product that people want. So Mises speaks of the dollar votes of consumers, that people are really voting by spending on various products, on who should be in control of the means of production. If they're playing my song just a second. So you see how Mises is countering the socialist argument. The socialist said, look, under the free market, it's a small group of people who are in control. So Mises said, no, the people who seem to be in control are really just servants or of the consumers, because they're trying to make a profit, and to make a profit, they have to supply what the consumers want. So it's really the consumers' preferences that are running the show. And Mises, taking over a phrase from the British economist W.H. Hutt, who taught for most of his career in South Africa, Hutt used the phrase consumer sovereignty. Mises takes this over. So he says that it's really the free market is a system of consumer sovereignty. I should mention, Hutt is one of the most great economists, but had a very difficult style. In fact, someone, I think it was Richard Ebeling, said that he wrote in Huttite. Yes, that was supposed to be funny. Okay, now, there's an objection, kind of an obvious objection one could give to this argument, namely that under capitalism, it's the consumers who are really in control, because the consumers are the business people are trying to please the consumers, So it's really the consumers who are in control. Now, the objection is, and you'll find this objection given, say, by the Cambridge economist Maurice Dobb, who taught at Cambridge during the 1930s. He was also a recruiting agent for Soviet espionage. But he said, well, look, you can talk about dollar votes, but rich people have many more dollar votes than poor people. So isn't it still the case that capitalism is an objectionable system? Because you can say, well, people vote according to the production depends on the votes, as it were, of the consumers, but rich people have a lot more votes. But Mises was well prepared for this objection. He answered that even if individual rich people have, say, an individual rich person has more votes than any poor person, still, if you add up all the votes of the masses of the people, you'll get an extremely substantial amount. And Mises describes capitalism as mass production for the masses. So even if it's the case that rich people individually have more dollar votes, their votes are really not able to outweigh the votes of the masses. Now, there's another point that's related to that, is where the free market compares favorably with political democracy. In a democracy, say, as we have in the U.S., if in fact we have a democracy, say we have two candidates for president, well, the ones who voted for the losing candidate don't get what they want. It's a winner take all. Now, we could have modifications of that. There are systems of proportional representation where parties that don't get that many votes still get representation in the legislature. But it's still the case, if you're on the losing side, you would not get what you voted for. But under the free market, many more preferences can be satisfied. If you want some product that not too many people want, say you want pro wrestling memorabilia, as long as there are some people who want this, then the market will tend to supply it. You don't have to have your preference voted for by everybody. So a lot of people can get their rather idiosyncratic preferences satisfied. So if you want a copy of Lou Thesz's autobiography, you'll be able to get it, even though that isn't a bestseller, unfortunately. Now, I use the phrase consumer sovereignty, but there's a very interesting objection that Murray Rothbard raised to this, that he said, well, it's really wrong to talk about sovereignty, because sovereignty is a political term. And if we say, in the United States, we talk about the sovereignty of the government or the sovereignty of the states. Well, this means the government can give us orders, and if we don't obey these orders, then they can use force against us. Say, if you decided you didn't want to pay your tax bill to the IRS and you just didn't send the money, well, they're going to keep sending you letters, and if you don't answer those, they'll eventually come and make a call on you, and they can really, if you kept resisting, they could actually shoot you. You'd be forced to pay. You wouldn't have a choice of whether to pay or not. But Rothbard said, well, look, this isn't the case in the free market. Suppose some businessman says, look, I don't care what the consumers want. I'm just going to produce things my way. Let's suppose somebody has a restaurant and says, this is home-cooked meals here. I cook just the way my mother did. Unfortunately, his mother burned everything. So people aren't going to like what that restaurant is serving. But it's his restaurant. He can do it if he wants. So it isn't really, Rothbard objected, this isn't really consumer sovereignty. Businesses aren't under the same kind of control as people are in the political system. I think Rothbard's point is quite right, but it doesn't really tell against the substance of what Mises was saying. Incidentally, Mises was quite aware of this point. He said it's not the same, that consumer sovereignty isn't the same as political sovereignty. But the point is that, say, businesses that don't try to please the consumers will tend to go out of business. If say, you had a restaurant and you serve products that people didn't want, they just didn't like the food you prepared, then people wouldn't go to that restaurant and you'd eventually go out of business. So you can refuse to do what the consumers want, but people who do that will tend to be replaced by those who are motivated by pleasing the consumers. Now, we now have another problem, is if what I've said is right, we can understand how businesses that directly supply the consumers will be guided by consumer preferences. That's say, say restaurants will be trying to serve food that their customers want. We can easily see how this works for consumer products. But a lot of the economy doesn't consist of products that are directly sold to consumers. We also have producers' goods or capital goods, goods that are used to produce other goods. And as you would have gotten in other lectures, I'm sure Roger Garrison mentioned this in his lecture, that you have stages of production. You can have producers' goods that are used to produce consumer goods, and you can have other production goods that are used to produce the first level production goods, and so on. So what about all the producers' goods? The consumers aren't choosing them. So then one could say, is it the case then that the consumer sovereignty, to the extent it exists, is limited? The dollar votes are just for the consumer goods. But this isn't right, because we could ask, well, what determines the demand for the producer's goods? Well, for the first level producer's goods, we'll get the people who are producing consumer's goods. So the preferences, what that demand is, we have to know which consumers' firms are going to be the ones that are demanding the producers' goods. But we already know the answer to that. Those are the producers of consumers' goods that please the consumers. So those people are going to be the ones who will be the demanders of the first level production goods. And if that's, and we can then just extend that more and more, that the demand for the higher stage of production will be based on the next lower stage demand. So once we're given the consumer's demand, that will determine the demands of the whole system. So it really is the consumers' demands that are running the show, and the details of that you can find in Mises and Rothbard. fortunately, I don't have to give those details. I get to concentrate on awful subjects like the a priori, and the details of the structure of production are left to other people who understand them. So, as I say, the ones who produce the consumer goods will demand the first level production goods, and they're trying to get them at the least cost. So the ones who, I guess that point rings a bell with someone. tell them the consumer demand doesn't permit me to answer right now. Okay, so I've gone over this. The producers of the first level production goods will be trying to meet demands of those produced consumer goods. Producers of the second level production goods will try to meet demands of those who produce first level production goods. So it's consumer demand thus determines all production. Now, there's another problem. Objections to the free market are very, very common. People never stop raising them. Now, one further objection really takes off from just the point I've been making. The point I've been making, whether successfully or not, is for you to judge, is that in the free market, the business people are trying to satisfy the demands of the consumers, whether they're directly producing consumer goods or at some higher stage of production. And why is it that they're trying to satisfy the demands of the consumers? Well, because they're trying to make money, and the way you make money is by getting people to buy your product. So this leads to another objection, is that in this system, people are motivated by trying to make money. But the objection is, that isn't a very nice thing to be motivated by. People should be motivated by other concerns, say moral concerns. They should say people should always pay workers a living wage or avoid charging high prices for necessities. The view would be, really, if you're concentrating on making money, that's really evil. As the Bible says, you cannot serve both God and mammon. Mammon, of course, is a term for money. Incidentally, Samuel Butler once said about that phrase, you cannot serve both God and mammon, difficult, no doubt, but nothing worth doing in life is easy. Of course, one response to this, say we could imagine the objectivist response of Ayn Rand, is that making money is good. It is a good thing. But again, this isn't the line Mises takes, because remember once more, he doesn't believe in objective ethics, not just in the sense of rejecting the objectivist system, but he doesn't think they're standards of good and bad that are just true or false. He just thinks ultimately there are subjective preferences. So he's not going to respond by saying, look, you're wrong, money, making money is good. What his response is to say, well, supposing the business person acts according to some other standard, say the business person says, look, I could make money, say, on this medication by charging a lot of money, but I'd rather make it available to poor people, so I'm going to sell it at a very low price. Well, what happens if business people do that? Then this mechanism that I explained in the first part of the lecture won't be operating, because the key to that system is that business people are trying to satisfy the demands of the consumers, and that what motivates them to do that is the pursuit of profit. So if they're not pursuing profit, then there won't be a mechanism, or at least not that mechanism, for getting the production to satisfy what the consumers want. Business people will be producing according to whatever standards they think are appropriate. Now, the problem here is that, suppose you said, okay, well, that's all right. People should just follow certain rules of morality, determine what to produce. Mises raises the problem. He said, well, the people who say that are just giving certain general statements like people should get a living wage or we should have fair prices, but they don't give any criterion of what the correct prices or wages are. They just said, well, people should be fair. People shouldn't just go after money as much as possible, but they don't have any rules for what prices are, and this will lead to chaos in the economy. If, business people don't charge the market price for something, that'll lead to either surpluses or shortages. We won't be able to coordinate the economy without the market prices that are where we have the businesses are responding to consumer demand based on their pursuit of profit. If they're not pursuing profit, that's going to derail the whole system. Incidentally, if you'll pardon, I'm a very old man, so I can perhaps make a few digression or two. You notice I use the word criterion. If the singular is form, like we taught you speak of a criterion, the singular is not criteria. One hears, unfortunately, people say we don't have a criteria for this, but that one really shouldn't say that. I remember when I was in Friedrich Hayek's class a long time ago, a student used the word phenomena in the singular, and Hayek stopped him and he said, oh, that hurts his ears. Would please don't say that. So that was, I think that's worth noting. It was a quite singular phenomenon. When Mises makes this point, namely that the system of free enterprise depends on the pursuit of profit by the business people, by the entrepreneurs, he's not making a value judgment. He's not saying, if you say that people should just charge fair prices, you're saying something that's bad, or you're making an ethically wrong judgment. He's not saying, well, I like the free market, so we should do it this way, even though it's quite obvious he does like the free market. What he's doing is just calling attention to the consequences of a particular policy. So he's saying, we need prices, market prices for economic calculation. We're not going to get them without the entrepreneur pursuing profit. When he says that, that's a descriptive statement. It's a scientific statement. It's either true or false. It isn't a value judgment. It's a statement of what are the consequences of a particular policy. So you see, this is a characteristic pattern that Mises uses. He's saying, rather than give his own ethical opinions, he's going to say, let's take what you want, what you, the objection to capitalism want. He's going to show what you say won't work. In doing that, he's making value-free claims. Now, we've been talking so far about socialist criticisms of the free market. I say the socialist says that the economy should be run by a system of government control instead of having businesses decide on what to produce independently of one another. We have a central plan where the government runs everything. And as I mentioned, that was a very popular system when Mises was writing, but it isn't so favored now. But there's another way, as I'm sure you all know, that the government can interfere with the free market besides taking over production of goods and services. And in this, the government doesn't abolish the market, but it passes laws that restrict market transactions in certain ways. For example, price control, which would include minimum wage laws and rent control and tariff. Price control usually is one that has a maximum price, saying you can't charge more than such and such for prices. Say, imagine there's a big hurricane, and then people want gasoline. So if you had a price control law, said something like you can't charge more than $6 a gallon for gasoline, that would be an example. Price control. Minimum wage laws are a form of price control, but it's a minimum price. It would say you can't employ someone for less than a particular amount. Rent control, again, would be a maximum price, as you can't charge more than a certain amount for an apartment. Tariffs are another type of intervention. That would be a tax on foreign goods that are imported into a country. Now, again, we're going to see a pattern of argument that Mises uses that's quite similar to the one he used in refuting the socialist claim, or replying to the socialist claim, that under the free market, it's just a small group of evil capitalists who are controlling everything. What Mises is going to do with interventionism is, first, he takes the goal that the interventionist wants, and then he says, the intervention that you're proposing won't enable you to achieve this goal. It'll fail. And you notice once more, and this is a point I'm particularly concerned to stress, that this is not a value judgment on his part. He's not saying interventionism is bad or I don't like interventionism. He's just saying if you try to put into effect a certain interventionist measure, it's not going to work. You have to be a bit careful there, because it's extremely likely true that Mises himself would make the value judgment interventionism is bad, or people who were attracted to Austrian economics, saying who believed, unlike Mises, in an objective ethics, would very likely think price control is ethically bad. But even if people hold that view, it's still the case that if one says that the intervention doesn't work, that's not a value judgment. Now, let's take an example of price control. And this is, example of price control on milk, because it's one that Mises himself uses. So the government, we imagine, says it's very hard for poor people to buy enough milk. Say they need milk for their small children, but the price of milk is too high. So the government isn't going to be cowed by that situation. I see at least one person laughed at that. Good. Okay, so the government says, well, if we lower the price of milk, that'll make it more available for poor people. So the government then decides to impose a maximum price on milk in order to make it easier for the poor to buy milk. Now, what's going to happen if the government does that? Well, the price of milk is now lower, so more people are going to, there's going to be greater quantity of milk demanded than before, because we know when the price decreases, the quantity demanded will either increase. In some cases it can stay the same, but it will never decrease, because if the price is lower, then people don't have to give up as much of other things in order to get the milk. They can get milk more easily. So there'll be more people, or more people demanding milk, but suppliers aren't going to be supplying more milk. They, when the price goes down, they're going to be getting less for each bottle of milk they sell. They'll have no incentive to increase production. In fact, they may decrease production. And in fact, the marginal sellers, that's to say, those who were just making enough to stay in the milk supply business, will be driven out of business by the this regulation. Say Mises is assuming that the milk sellers are making, not all the milk sellers are making the same rate of profit. There are some who are doing pretty well. Others are just making enough to get by on. So you can see he's assuming that the economy isn't in equilibrium, because in equilibrium, everybody will make the same rate of return. But here he's assuming that there are some people who are not doing as well as others. So the ones who were just barely making enough to stay in business will go out of business. They won't be able to stay in business under the new regulation. So what is the upshot of all this? Is that the government put in the price control, the maximum price for milk, because it wanted to have milk, more milk available to people, especially to the poor. But the result is that there's less milk available. So this isn't what the price control is supposed to do. So you see, when Mises is pointing this out, once again, he's not making a value judgment. He's not saying, I don't like price control on milk. He's just saying, this was what will happen. You won't get what you want if you have price control on milk. It'll make people leave the milk supply business. Incidentally, I didn't put a slide on it. There are a couple cases, by the way, where there are exceptions to this general principle, where if you have a price control, it'll drive the marginal sellers out. They'll shift their resources to other more profitable businesses. One case where it wouldn't is, suppose all the resources in a particular line of work are completely specialized. They're all used up. They're all used in that industry, and there's nowhere else they could go profitably. Then they won't leave the industry as long as the business can make a profit at all. They won't have the incentive to say, well, now I can move to some other line of work, because the resources will be completely specialized. But even in that case, you'd still have the problem of greater quantity demanded at the price control the price set by price control then would be supplied at that price, so that wouldn't eliminate the problem. Now, once we've got that pattern for price control, the rent control is very easily analyzed because it's exactly the same process. So again, the aim of rent control is to make more housing available for the poor. So what's going to happen, though, if you put in rent control? Well, at the rent-controlled amount, there'll be more housing demanded than is available. So then landlords that can't make money will withdraw housing from the market, or they'll respond to the rent control by just not making repairs on their apartments. So once more, you'll have a situation where the rent control won't get what the people who favored it wanted. They say they wanted to have more housing available for the poor. The result is less housing available. You know, I remember, speaking of rent control, there was a story I'll tell you. That have any of you read Robert Nozick, the great libertarian philosopher? Is that a name people know? Nobody's read Nozick. Some people have. Well, he was a very outstanding philosopher. He was a libertarian. He taught at Harvard. So he got into a bit of trouble that he was renting an apartment from Eric Segal of Love Story fame, but it turned out not to be a love story between them. I think he wanted certain repairs in the apartment, and Segal wasn't too friendly to me. Told him, talk to my lawyers. So then it turned out, Nozick looked this up, the apartment was supposed to be under rent control, and Nozick, he was paying more than that, so he sued for all the back rent plus penalties. I think he got about $20,000. Then Segal was a friend of the Martin Peretz, who was the owner at that time, the New Republic magazine. And they published an article on this incident, making fun of Nozick because he was a libertarian against rent control, but he used the lawsuit to take advantage of this. And I remember I was they're really playing my song now. I guess we have some rent control people who don't like what I'm saying. So I remember Tom Nagel said to me, who's also a very well-known philosopher, he said, "I don't get it. What's the inconsistency?" But any event, I just thought I'd throw that story in. Why not? Okay, so as we say, rent control doesn't attain the aim that its proponents favor. Again, we're not making a value judgment. So the rent control advocates wanted more housing for the poor, but the result is they get less housing for the poor. Again, let's see this pattern once more with minimum wage laws. Now, minimum wage law is supposed to raise wages for workers. It's saying, look, workers, say at Walmart, aren't getting a living wage. The expression living wage, incidentally, is something that came in really with the famous encyclical of Pope Leo XIII, Rerum Novarum, which came out in 1891. So the view there was the employer should pay the worker enough so he would be able to live and support a family. So the minimum wage advocates would say, look, some wages don't permit workers to do that, so why don't we just pass a law that says employers have to pay workers enough so they'll have a, so they'll be able to support themselves. Now, what's going to happen if they do that? Well, a minimum wage is a minimum price. It says prices can't fall below this amount. So if you have that and that's higher than the market price, then more workers will want to work at this minimum wage than employers are willing to hire at that price. How do we know that? Well, what determines in the free market, what determines how much the employee is going to get, what determines wages? Well, it's basically determined by how much the employee's product is worth to the employer. If, say, you have a minimum wage and what you produce isn't worth that to the employee, what you're, say, you have a minimum wage, let's say, of $9, but you can only produce, say, $6 worth of product per hour, then it doesn't pay the employer to hire you. He's going to let you go. You know, when you consider that, I'm wondering how it is that I managed to stay employed. But I, fortunately, I'm not going to go into, I hope Lou Rockwell isn't listening to this particular part of the lecture. Okay, so the minimum wage law then, again, that will is supposed to help the poor workers, saying these workers aren't getting enough to live on, but it'll have the effect of making at least some of the workers unemployed. So again, it's not going to do what it's supposed to do. Again, as you'll be tired of hearing by now, but that's not going to stop me, this is not a value judgment. It's just saying this is the consequence of what's going to happen. I should say there are various replies that minimum wage advocates will give to that. For example, one, they'll say, well, you know, according to the theory of this, that your wages are determined by the marginal productivity of the workers, the discounted marginal value product. But even if that's true, there are wide zones of indeterminacy that give room for the employees to get more. That's one of the responses. I don't think there's much to that response, but I'm not going to go into the controversy over that. If the economist I mentioned before, W.H. Hutt, has written on that issue in a number of books. If you're interested in pursuing minimum wage legislation further. Now, again, we have, we want to give one more example of this similar pattern. This is a tariff. A tariff, as I say, is a tax imposed on foreign goods are imported into a country. So supposing people say, well, it's very unfair, say, producers of American cars are being undersold by Japanese cars, so we're going to impose a tariff on the Japanese car coming in, and then this will help American workers. That if you didn't have a tariff, then the workers who produced American cars would lose their job because they would be out-competed by the suppliers of Japanese cars. So isn't it a good idea we just impose the tariff and this will help the American workers? But what's overlooked there, it's kind of a very obvious point, is that the tariff will make the product more costly for consumers, that if you didn't have a tariff, say the Japanese people would have bought the Japanese car at a lower price, then the people who would bought the cars are worse off. They'll have to pay more if they want a car than they otherwise would have. So they're not better off. I would say, oh, well, but look, the workers are better off. What the problem here is that the advocates of the tariff aren't taking into account the people who are harmed by it. They would just say, look, the tariff is helping such and such people. We've got to build up the manufacturing sector of the economy. But they're neglecting the fact that consumers will have to pay higher prices because of the tariffs. And further, by discouraging competition, they make it easier to form cartels, that's say, agreements among businesses to fix prices. Now, what happens when intervention fails? Well, perhaps in an almost ideal world, the government say, let's forget about the intervention, let's go to the free market. I won't say in an ideal world, because in an ideal world, there wouldn't be any intervention in any government at all. But in a close to ideal world, the government would say, let's forget about the intervention and just go back to the free market. But very often the government won't do that. They'll just respond with more intervention. Say, let's go back to this example of price control on milk. Well, the milk sellers will complain they're not getting enough profit because of the price control. So the government might respond by putting price controls on the suppliers, say the ones, the milk suppliers will be getting their supplies of milk from dairy. So they might say, well, okay, those people will have to charge lower prices. So then you'll be able, when you're selling milk to the consumers, you'll be able to make a profit even though you're selling the milk at a lower price than before, because your costs will be lower. As long as your prices are above costs, you'll be all right. You want to avoid the position of the person who said he sold below cost, and someone asked him, how do you make any money if you sell below cost? He said, I make it up in volume. That wouldn't be such a good idea. Okay, so what's going to happen if they do that? Well, these new interventions will also fail for the very same reason that we've already given, that we already explained why price control doesn't work, why it will result in greater quantity demand than the quantity supply. It'll just cause more of a shortage at the next stage. So the new interventions don't work. Now, what happens if the government says, okay, well, we're not giving up, we're just going to keep having more intervention? Eventually, it won't take very long if they just keep with more and more price control, you'll get total government control of the economy. The government will be controlling all prices. They'll start with having price controls on a few products, and they'll say, well, we need to have further price controls because otherwise some of the people we're supplying the first goods will go out of business. So then they're going to extend this over the whole economy. So then you'll get total government control of the economy. And this is not just a theoretical possibility. It took place in Germany in World War I, and also happened, it was the system there was called the Hindenburg Plan, after Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, who was one of the main military leader Germany during World War I. He was very, very popular, even though Germany didn't do that well at the end of the war, but he was very popular. So the plan was called the Hindenburg Plan. And the same thing happened in England during World War I, also during World War II. You had total government control of the whole economy. And I think very interesting, the Mises says that socialism did not come to Britain, as most people will say, it with the labor government, which came in just at the end of World War II, labor government under Clement Attlee, but came in under Winston Churchill, who was ostensibly a conservative. He was supposed to be a supporter, at least to some extent, of the free market, but Mises said that really it was Churchill who brought about socialism to England. Incidentally, Churchill remarked once about Clement Attlee, who was the leader of the Labour Party. He said he's a very modest man. He has a great deal to be modest about. Now, the system where you have a government in control of the economy, the government is setting all the price and wages, was also characteristic of the Nazi economy. Remember, Hitler came to power in January 30th, 1933, and he was in power till the end of World War II, 1945. But particularly after 1936, you had the German government really was in setting all the prices and wages in the economy. And this is another kind of fundamental point Mises makes, that this is a form of socialism. You have socialism is not only one where the government owns the means of production and runs things by a central plan. Another form of socialism is one where it looks legally like you have private businesses and private property, but really the government is set making all the decisions. So this is also a form of socialism. And because it's a form of socialism, Mises said the Marxist interpretation of the Nazism is completely wrong. And Marxist says that the Nazi system was really a stage of capitalism. They said this is capitalism with the gloves off, that it's really the capitalists, the rich businessmen, the really big firms who were in control under the Nazis. But in fact, this wasn't true. It was really the government that was running things. So now the last point I want to make, again, is another type of intervention where Mises is using the same pattern that I've given in the lecture, that many people favor very heavy taxes on the rich. So again, Mises isn't going to say, as many libertarians would, look, if you tax people, this is a form of forced labor or it's interfering with natural rights. I think those are very good points to make, but they're not the ones Mises make. He said the taxes make it more difficult for the rich to save and build up accumulations of capital. And what happens if capital accumulates? Then it's going to raise the productivity of workers, and that will make wages rise. So he says taxes on the rich will really hurt the poor. So again, it's not having the consequence that the supporters of taxation on the rich say it will. So I think now we're about out of time, so I think thanks very much. As long as, now, sorry, don't support heavy taxes on the rich will be my final message. Thank you.